Thanks for your help, Pei. I thought it was worth having a second bite at James. Not you, James. Because there's, like Anne said in her introduction, there's just some really good pearls of wisdom to be found here and well worth our attention again. James is very practical and down to earth and yet is not constrained by the world's ways of doing things. In this section, James touches on a number of common practical dynamics and challenges the way that we kind of more default do things and wants us to consider a different way. And he starts off with the area of partiality. Now, are you familiar with partiality, where you prefer one person over the other? Let's think about this. One of the features of a pluralist society is that none of us are identical. There are a multiplicity of subcultures and individual preferences, and these find expression in a range of choices and allegiances. And that's kind of just how we do life. You might even say the recent backlash against multiculturalism can be seen as something of a reaction against the sense that a single dominant culture is not so dominant anymore, and people are a bit scared by that because they've been used to a single dominant culture and it's not as dominant, and so there's a bit of a backlash in some places. But there are kind of meta patterns of preference even in our multicultural context. With few exceptions, most people around the world, for example, are drawn towards wealth. That's just something that is kind of human, if you like. It also, maybe not as common, but still pretty common, many cultures are fascinated by celebrity, popularity. These are things that are kind of metacultural. They're just something human about it. We're fascinated with these sorts of things. I wonder what you're drawn to. Or to put it another way, who do you notice? Because we tend to notice people who have the things that we want, whether it's a sense of identity in the community or standing of some kind in the community or an intellectual capacity perhaps, or musical talent it could be, or beautiful clothes. Ray's not here this morning, but I'm drawn to his shirts. We are drawn to those who we would like to be like. There's almost an unconscious idea of infection in this kind of notion. We want to be influenced by the people who have and are what we would like to be and have. Now, this is why deluxe brands almost never sell their products by telling you about their actual product. They have somebody they think that you will like, who is kind of a brand in themselves, kind of be associated with their product. So George Clooney uses Nespresso. You may not know that, but I like George Clooney. I don't like Nespresso, but there you are. Simon Baker wears Longines watches. And a more recent eventuation is on social media, there are people called influencers. And depending on how many followers they've got, they can attract companies who will say, in your next post, could you wear one of our tops and just mention that? And they get paid to do it. Because they know that people like those people, and if they like those people, they want to be like those people, and so they'll buy their products. And we know this at a more fundamental way as well. We want our children to hang out with good kids, don't we? Because if they hang out with bad kids, we're kind of scared they'll become a bit more like the bad kids, and we want them to be more like the good kids. As adults, we might choose mentors based on people we respect and would like to be like. It's not really rocket science, is it? So what's so wrong with showing partiality? It seems a natural social dynamic. Why should James be so against it? And I think this is the reason. Because the other side is we tend to avoid or even shun those we do not want to be like. Not just people who might, say, have qualities that we don't like, but also people who end up in situations that we don't want to end up in. Somebody who's poor, for example, we might just subconsciously think, well, I don't want to be poor, so I don't really want to be too closely associated with that person. It happens kind of in a way that we're not conscious of. One expression of this is that we tend to shun fringe dwellers. We don't want to become somebody out on the fringe, so people who are kind of fringe dwellers, we don't want to closely associate with. We instinctually do not want to be identified with them. We consider ourselves to be gracious even when we tolerate them, because that seems very generous of us to allow them in our midst, in one sense. But James is picking up on the reality that the fellowship of the followers of Jesus are actually a band of outsiders. That's who we are, because our leader was tried as an insurgent. He was found guilty by his government of insurrectionist tendencies and disrespect for the law, and all those who follow him become fringe dwellers by virtue of following him. He is an outsider. We follow an outsider. We are a band of outsiders. And so it's incongruous to treat someone as more important or less important because we're all outsiders. It's a funny kind of thing. We are the fellowship of the least, where the first is last and the last is first. And the only way to climb the ladder in this place is down to become the servant. I once saw a cartoon. I thought it was a Looney cartoon, but I've never been able to find it again. It captured my imagination. It was God talking to an archbishop. And God was saying to the archbishop, "You have been a faithful archbishop. You have done all I've asked you to do, and I'm going to reward you. You may now become a bishop." And then the next frame is he's talking to the same person who's now a bishop. He says, "You have been a faithful bishop. You've done all that I've asked and called you to do. I'm now going to grant you to become a parish priest." And on it goes until it gets to the last frame where he's just a normal guy and he says, "You've been faithful as a normal person. I'm going to let you become a vagrant." And in this really beautiful way, it conveys the sense that the first are last, and the last are first, and the freedom from all these cultural expectations so that you might just be who you are and be loved for who you are. And so James goes on and says, don't be too quick to judge, because judging is a really dangerous business. Law indicates what's acceptable and what is unacceptable in a society. In a lawless society, anything goes. It's chaotic and dangerous. And so we have in our Western liberal democracies, we have an agreed set of behaviours that are acceptable in the community, and they become our law. And if you transgress them, there are punishments. And that's all really appropriate. James is not saying that we should not have law or that there should be no law. James is not suggesting that what a person does doesn't matter, because it's quite the opposite. He's saying what you do really does matter. What he's saying is, you are not the judge. You didn't make the law, and you are not the judge in relation to the law, certainly the law of God. You are not the arbiter of who has transgressed or to what degree they have transgressed. And he says that we will be judged on the same basis that we judge other people, which, quite frankly, is frightening for most of us most of the time. The thought of God judging me with the same level of capacity I have to show grace, it really is a very terrifying thing. But there's a more immediate way in which this affects our everyday lives. However you judge others, you will also be judging yourself. That is, unless you're so mentally unwell that you've divided yourself off and you can do one thing over here and one thing over there, but that's also a judgment in and of itself. We have a consistency in this that means that we will actually judge ourselves in the same way that we judge other people. And frequently we reject most fervently those things which we are aware are in ourselves and we don't like in ourselves, and so we take it out on another person and reject that really harshly. For most of my Christian life, I've considered myself to be a fairly together Christian. I might have told you this story. It made it difficult not to, you know, hum that song, "Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble." And I could easily slip into an air of superiority. I didn't like to judge others, but I was secretly glad I was not like them. And I think of those two guys going up to the temple to pray, and one of them said, "Lord, I thank you I am not like other men," and goes on and enumerates how good he is. I was like that guy. And then we adopted our kids, our beautiful girls. And that was I'm talking about you, Pay, not to you. And I didn't know how to do fatherhood very well, and so that really challenged me profoundly and deeply, and I didn't cope. And I experienced feelings of worthlessness that would frequently jump over into an expression of rage that was uncontrolled and very unpleasant for everybody, including me, but certainly others around me. And that would then settle down into a sense of failure as a person and as a father. It was very distressing and a very deconstructing journey. It left me seeing myself more honestly than I had ever seen myself before. And it required that I accept myself more deeply and more fully than I'd ever had to before. I had to not only accept that I was just like all others, I had to, in a heartfelt way, pray, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." I'd changed and become the other guy at the temple. And the upshot is that I am more merciful with myself, and I am instinctually more merciful with others, because I know they are just like me and I am just like them. And James says, mercy triumphs over judgment. And it really does, because whereas judgment protects life, that's why we have judges, they want to protect the law and protect the community, mercy gives life. It sets people free to live again. And it's a beautiful thing. Mercy has more power for good than judgment. It overpowers, it triumphs over judgment. And so faith must be lived. And in our Western world, we really understand the power of words, and we love words, and we use them all the time. But words only have power if they convey something meaningful. And sometimes we use words for the purpose of hiding things, maybe even hiding reality from ourselves. If a person says, "Be clothed and fed," to somebody who isn't doing very well, doesn't have enough food and enough clothing, and yet does nothing to respond at a practical level, those words serve to obscure the needy person's precarious situation, as if we can just bless them and they'll be all right. A person could say nothing at all in that situation, but that tends to highlight the lack of care, doesn't it? So sometimes we will say something rather than saying nothing, because it's easy to say something, it's much harder to actually do something. I heard a story once about a person who was new at a church, and the church was very welcoming, and so the new person came in, and people would say, "Oh, lovely to see you. It's great to have you here. We must have you over sometime." And the second week they came along, and a very similar situation happened. "Oh, lovely meeting you for the first time. Great, we must have you over sometime." And yet no actual invitations to have the person over sometime ever eventuated. And you've got to wonder what's going on there, because maybe the church wanted to be people who looked like they were hospitable, but they weren't actually hospitable. And so our actions are more eloquent, more sharply accurate with regard to what's going on for us than our words. We must be careful not to use empty words, empty signifiers, things that have no meaning in reality, because it just devalues the currency of language. I'm sure each of us know people who, when they speak, we take what they say with a grain of salt. We might politely name that way because we actually know they're not good for their word. And that's not to say that they're bad people. It's just that we know that somehow they have good intention that we know isn't connected to their capacity or their desire to follow through. And for whatever reason, their words should not be taken as an indication of the way they will act. Their words are empty. But James says, let your faith be lived in reality. James wants to make it clear that faith always finds expression in real life. If it does not,